As this worldwide conflict enters its 19th week, we find this morning that Corregidor still holds out in the Philippines. North of Australia, United Nations make smashing attacks on the enemy, while in Europe, the armies of the Soviet continue their drive against the Axis forces. At this time, we are to hear the latest reports from the far corners of the world. First, from the land down under.
This is Martin Nagronsky calling from American Army headquarters in Australia. From the notes of my diary for this past week, I find it hard to strike even a faintly optimistic balance on the course of the Far Eastern War. Against the fall of Bataan, the loss of two British cruisers and an aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean, the still unchecked, steady Jap advance in Burma, and most important of all, against the complete breakdown of the Cripps negotiations with India, the success side of the Allied ledger can stack only one item: the successful Allied aerial attacks from Australia against Jap bases in New Guinea and the approaches to the northern Australian coast. And the Allied air attacks, though consistently well executed and moderately damaging, are pretty small potatoes when compared to these Jap successes. I can't know what you're thinking at home, but I can honestly report to you that responsible observers here are increasingly disturbed at the painful contrast between constant talk of Allied offensive action and equally constant Allied failure to do anything but talk. It may be that we're too close to the trees to see the wood, but to us here it seems to stick out like a sore thumb that it's time to chuck the conferences overboard and bring all the Allied strength to bear on remedying what may become an irremediable position in the Far East if allowed to deteriorate much further. Through the notes of all my conversations this week with American and Australian leaders, I find there runs consistently one common observation. It is that the Allied Supreme Council still seems to exhibit a dangerous lack of cohesion and decision. Yesterday, in summing up, I made this note. I quote, "Everybody here seems agreed on at least two things. One, that on the record we are still waging a defensive war, though we talk of fighting an offensive war. And two, that something must be basically wrong with either our directors of strategy or our strategy itself to keep us perpetually unable to take the necessary offensive action. On Friday, I spent 2 hours with a certain American. He was in a position to know as well as anyone the Jap military strength in this area. He told me that it was the considered opinion of qualified experts that in all the Jap campaigns in this part of the Far East, that is starting in Malaya and then in the Dutch East Indies, in the Philippines, and throughout the island territories in the Australian neighborhood, the Japs never used more than 500,000 troops. When I said that figure was almost impossible to believe, he said bitterly, and I quote his words, "From the first day of this war, the Japs have stuck faithfully to the precept that an American general first made famous. That is, get their fustest with the mostest." It's been common practice for our apologists to blame the Jap success so far on a so-called unlimited supply of manpower. Yet I find that almost to a man, our most capable military leaders are agreed that this is a totally fallacious argument. Invariably, in analyzing any one of the Jap campaigns, they can prove that the Jap secret has been one of concentration at the needed point at the right time. It is unfortunately true that we were not prepared, neither Britain nor the United States, at the outbreak of the Far Eastern War. But equally it's true that we have never made the most of what we had, and today, of what we have. Certainly the Allied problem is painfully difficult. With the German threat to the Middle East and Russia, the Jap threat to India and Australia, it would be a wonder if our strategists didn't spin like tops in an effort to decide how to dispose our available men and supplies to the best advantage. The enemy has the advantage of the initiative, but still, we increase his advantage by our apparent inability to decide in what theater we really intend to concentrate our real offensive power. It's not good enough to argue that all the theaters of this war are equally important. The best qualified school of strategic opinion here feels there is an absolute necessity now to realize that if we have not enough to fight effectively everywhere, we must decide ruthlessly exactly where we can fight most effectively and concentrate on that place. If it means one theater may have to go under, and that could mean either this country or India, well, God help that people, but the war must be won. And above all, it is spelled here, we must use every ounce of our strength to hit at the enemy. I want to pass on to you the remark of an American naval officer. He said to me, I quote, "I wonder how many people remember the fate of the German Navy in the last war." Throughout, the Germans prided themselves on their ability to keep what was left of their fleet intact. They kept it intact for the day at the end of the war when it steamed the Scapa Flow, and still intact was scuttled. This is Martin Nagroski returning you now to San Francisco.
And now from the Pacific Coast, we take you across the continent to our newsroom in New York.
For word on developments across the Atlantic, we switch next to London and the report of John McVane.
This is London. British bombers last night made more heavy attacks on the Ruhr industrial region of Germany. They also flew the long trip to Italy to bomb points in the northern part of the country. German aerodromes in France and the Low Countries were attacked, and the Le Havre docks got another bombing. 10 British bombers and one fighter are missing. People who live near the English Channel coast have started going back to the cliffs to watch the raids on the Germans across the channel. One observer on the coast, commenting on the fact that most of the battling takes place over enemy territory, said, "This has been a weekend of blitzes, of roaring RAF bombers and fighters." It was revealed today that Lord Louis Mountbatten, cousin of the King and a brilliant Navy officer, succeeded Sir Roger Keyes as Chief of Combined Operations. He took over last October, and on March 18th, he was given the rank of Vice Admiral. That means that Admiral Mountbatten is head of the planning and execution of the commando raids and anything else that the three services carry out together on enemy territory. He's generally reckoned one of the best possible choices for the job. He's shown a lot of bravery and coolness under fire during this war, and people who should know say he has a keen military brain. The success of the recent commando raids seems to prove the point. Some information on the Japanese force that went into action against the Dorsetshire, Cornwall, and Hermes, the three British warships sunk in the Indian Ocean, was given in London today. It was stated that the Japanese force consisted of three battleships, including one modern 16-inch gunner, five aircraft carriers, numerous light and heavy cruisers, and destroyer flotillas. It was said to be impossible to indicate the strength of the British forces under the command of Sir James Somerville, or the dispositions he took against superior enemy forces. But London still has complete faith in the British Admiral's ability. It was also disclosed that in the big Japanese attacks against Colombo and Trincomalee on the island of Ceylon, harbor and shore establishments were damaged, as well as a few ships which remained in harbor. General Gordon Bennett's account of the Malaya operations has been received, but isn't considered suitable for publication. General Wavell has been asked to collect all available information on Malaya, and it's been said that none of the lessons to be learned will be lost. Dispatches reaching London today say that Sir Stafford Cripps has left Karachi, India, on his way home. British financial experts in London are speculating about the new budget that will be introduced into the House of Commons soon. One writer has his exposition published in a London afternoon paper under the headline, "High Taxes Are Good for Us." This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And here is news from Russia. Kuibyshev. Soviet forces are turning nature against the Germans in spectacular fashion. Nazi troops in a strongly fortified village on the Eastern Front were literally washed out when Red Army sappers turned a flood-swollen stream into the village. Steady rains are said to be falling over the front. In one rain-drenched battle, Russian units are said to have recaptured a town in the Bryansk sector and two other points on the Kalinin Front. And Red Army dispatches quote captured Germans as saying Nazi losses were frightful during reckless attacks ordered on the Leningrad Front. Russians have taken heart from an official statement that a German offensive this spring appears most unlikely. A Soviet brigade commissar says he bases his belief on the quality of reinforcements the Germans are sending to the front. According to the commissar, the Nazi reinforcements include half-trained men, semi-invalids, and others still suffering from wounds. Jerusalem. A Swedish freighter recently carried 7,000 tons of Australian wheat to the Greek port of Piraeus. Crew members say the Greek stevedores there were so hungry and exhausted they were hardly able to unload the cargo. The Axis and United Nations arranged safe passage for the wheat to occupied Greece. Stockholm, Sweden. A German ecclesiastical commission is expected in Norway to try to settle the church conflict there. Four Norwegian bishops, you know, are under arrest. And 1,100 clergymen have resigned in protest against Nazi regulations. On Friday, Prime Minister Quisling of the Nazi-sponsored government gave the clergymen until 2 p.m. Saturday to return to their duties. However, it was announced yesterday that the order was held in abeyance for the time being. And now dispatches from Oslo indicate the Ecclesiastical Commission from Germany will try to halt the rising tide of unrest in Norway. Now, events here at home are reported by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. Washington turns up Monday morning with a little of the same old stuff. It all tastes alike, and that's the controversy on proposed labor legislation, which the reporters all say holds the principal attention in Washington. The only reason it holds the principal attention in Washington, I think, is that Washington is not permitted to see what's going on behind some very important closed doors. Senator Francis Maloney of Connecticut, who generally knows his stuff, says that labor and management may reach a voluntary agreement sometime this week. If you've been listening to me for the last month or so, I think you'll remember that I told you that was going on and predicted that it might happen. The president and other members of the administration are not willing that labor matters should be settled in the midst of a bitter political controversy. However, Senator Tom Connally of Texas wants to force the showdown in Congress. Other congressmen are still fighting to suspend the 40-hour work week. Now, we've heard all the possible changes on this rung on this theme. Now, let's hearken a moment. Far off, I think we hear a voice, and it sounds to me like the well-known White House spokesman, although that particular spokesman died with the Hoover regime. At any rate, Mr. Roosevelt is not asleep, nor is he satisfied with the rough economic road, the wages, the prices, the cost and profit situation. I would suggest looking for a comprehensive overall plan on wages, hours, economics, cost of living, and all that sort of thing, possibly this week, but sometime within the next 2 weeks, possibly. But remember, the production, which is the aim of all, the production of warplanes is way up, and we can easily reach the rate of 60,000 planes a year in 1942. And let me quote to you Don Nelson, the war production boss, who said this: "There is a Garand rifle for every man of our combat forces who is supposed to have one. And the point is that the Garand rifle is the best military rifle in the world with three times the firing power of the next best weapon. And incidentally, remember that nobody can use an Army rifle like an American soldier. The rifle is an American weapon, as was very ably demonstrated by the American Expeditionary Force under General Pershing, who had to fight his way through the Europeans who thought that the rifle was an outmoded weapon. We're ahead of the schedule on the manufacture of tanks. We're ahead of the schedule on the manufacture of the guns to put in the tanks and the guns to fire at the enemy tanks. The chief worry, they tell me in Washington this morning, is not labor, but material." And today, while Congress expects a terrific flare-up over the labor laws, and we're certainly going to have them, the 40-hour week and so forth and so on, I think the most significant statement comes from London, or from Royston, England, where Britain's labor minister, Bevin, has said that the war tide is turning and Britain will soon take the offensive. Of course, Marshall is there. He indicates, Bevin does, that a large factor in this turning is the Allied plane production, which I have been hinting to you for several days. Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House, brought it out last Thursday. Bevin says United States airplane production will be equal to the total output of Germany, Italy, and Japan in, listen, 5 or 6 weeks. This points to possible tremendous attack by the United Nations against the Axis, and we probably have more planes than flyers. And that's all from Washington at this time.
These have been reports by Martin Agronsky from Melbourne, John McVane from London, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Replacing the announced program, the National Broadcasting Company brings you a special news report from Free French Equatorial Africa. Hassel Davis has just returned to Brazzaville after covering the desert fighting along the Libyan front. And now we leave New York and travel by shortwave radio in imagination across the Pacific Ocean, across the Atlantic Ocean, to switch you to Hassel Davis in Brazzaville, French Equatorial Africa.
This is Hassel Davis speaking from Brazzaville on the Congo, the capital of full French Africa. I've just returned from a 4,000-mile trip through the desert of Chad, which was the first territory to rally to the Gaul, and the fabulous Tibesti Mountains, traveling by cloak and camel, and on the last lap by plane with General Leclerc, who commanded the amazing troops that recently took 5 Italian outposts and shot at the Libyan base in Rizik. I believe that nothing in all the African war can be compared to the heroism and downright dogged soldiering of this achievement. And largely it was as a result of it, Leclerc has been made Commander-in-Chief of all Free French African Forces. I wanted to see for myself the men who went with him and the legendary lost world they trekked over. I saw both intimately, the steel sand in my teeth as I talked. Dante's Inferno could have been no worse than that desolate land, inhabited only by nomads and baboons. The first troops were returning from Libya through a sandstorm when they reached the fortified oasis of Fayyum. There were white men as black as a burnt-out earth, but grinning through lips that were split by the sun like powerful sausages. There were no women to greet them, to coddle them, not even those professional consolers which the Germans and Italians so generously sent to their brother troops. White women are forbidden here. Here were only men to fight a man's desperate war, and among the ranks were native sirens, whose faces seemed cornered with patterned scars. Tuaregs, blue-veiled like women, but fierce as apes. Gaunt troopers from the mountaintops. They had waited a year in the desert for this last fight, until the general sent them north in 200 trucks. To cross its Tibesti Mountains, 10,000 feet high, they had to build their own roads as they went along. In the soft, sandy valleys, they made galvanized roof over them before the fields. Build over it, picked it up, lay it down again for days on end. And for 6 weeks they were forced to hide with their trucks in the mountain grottos while enemy aircraft reconnoitered overhead. As they approached the post of Riga Kabir through a petrified forest, with their food running low, they caught gazelles in mass, open and raw, as rifle shots and fire would have given the alarm. The post was taken completely by surprise. So was El Tatru, traveling only at night so the enemy aircraft shouldn't see them, guided by marine theodolites, sweeping out their tracks as they advanced, and on the last night, pushing their towers silently by man and thermal power, they finally surrounded the fort. In the early morning, a French officer took his cane and went walking casually past the sleepy native sentries and entered the room where the Italian commander was busy counting out pay for his troops, since this was the end of the war. He tapped the commander on the shoulder. "Imshi, get out," said the Italian, without looking up, thinking it was a native orderly. The Frenchman asked gently, "Do you mind paying me now, because your fort is surrounded?" His gun was at the nape of the other's neck. The third post was taken during the eclipse of the moon, which lasted 3 hours and allowed the French troops to approach in darkness. The Italian post was in an uproar of chanting and the beating of drums. The half-wild native troops thought the blacked-out moon meant the end of the world. The French gave them their world again when the Italians were captured and the moon reappeared, and those natives are now devoted to free French troops. But the post of Tajiri was not so easily taken. The French were tired. They were operating far from the nearest mobile base camp, and as over half the useful load of their trucks consisted of gas and water, they had 2 provisions with them. And little had been found in the forts previously taken. The Italian supply trucks, which they were expected to be, had sensed danger and turned around. On March the 1st, the anniversary of the victory at Kufra, the French assaulted Tajiri with mortars. The Italian plane spotted them, and a few minutes later, General Heiko appeared far overhead, radioing commands to the Italians both in the air and in the armored cars, as the prisoners admitted later. Every material way, the enemy was far superior. It was a mad assault, but General Leclerc took that post, too, where, ironically enough, the Italian guns and ammunition captured a year ago at Kufra, putting it back into its owner's jaws. The single free French plane miraculously drove into the antagonist's jaws. The Meharis, the jaunty camel corps, herded together the Italians who had fled into the dunes, blew up the ammunition stores they couldn't carry, and so corrupted the water hole with the carcasses of camels that the post cannot easily be used again. With General Leclerc, our free from fire to Zouar, with the black points of mountains jutting through the sand like the teeth of hell, and I took off my helmet to the men who had bullied and wheedled their troops over such terrible terrain. Far up lane, I saw nothing but sand-colored houses against the earth. In Zouar itself, I was shown the amazing fortifications of the post, the great guns hidden and manned day and night, the caves like those of Gibraltar and Corregidor, open ground with hundreds of armored cars are kept in bomb-proof storage. Blockhouses everywhere defending the only two roads by which the air can be approached through the mountains. The major in command was expecting a reprisal bombing daily, and daily looked forward to it, confident that whatever plane flew over would never leave that valley again. I talked with the Italian prisoners, mostly peasants, many of them dandies who should have been at home with their mandolins, but one, a captain and a gentleman, who told me how he'd fought France as a duty against his will. This is fratricide, he said. He was worried about his wife, from whom he'd had no word for 2 months. The French officers with me had not heard from their families in over 2 years. Other prisoners made quite plain to me their hatred of their German master, who ordered their every move and left them the worst of all provisions coming from their own division. I talked with a senior officer with the Camel Corps, and he was disillusioning about that supposedly romantic life. We had traveled 700 miles to get to the fighting. Well, why not seven pails of sandals? For all that while, because of the danger of the mountain passes, he had spent only 25 hours in his camel's back. And the cattle he had brought with him for food, he had had to slaughter. There was a hoof so worn down to the flesh by the rocks that are like sharp black glass. The first night his men passed at Chemessa, a Libyan oasis, their water bags burst, and their heart froze. Then they pinned their hopes on the great well of Liguri, and sought it by the indications of a solar compass in the car leading them. But when they came to it, they found it dry, for no rain had fallen here in over 3 years. Beside the pit were the mummified and perfectly preserved bodies of 3 Italian officers and 1 Jew. Somehow, the French survived, fought, and returned, the loss of 2 men only. Among these troops, I met artists, writers, scientists, a city planner whose hero was New York's Robert Mosey. All simple soldiers now, their tours behind and before them. The war they owned their only immediate job. Surely these all were heroes, but none more so than the young athlete captain who, finding a northwest post to destroy, led his men north to the strangely named region of Hun on the Italian communications world, less than 200 miles from the Mediterranean, and more than 1,000 miles of blood and sweat from his base at Fort Laramie. Like Arabia's Lawrence, his guerrilla troops swooped on the Italian Saharista, the desert fighters, as they passed, and all night long for us, fighting each with the ammunition they had captured from the one before. One Italian prisoner wept as his captive marched him to the tune of the Marseillaise. It made him homesick for Marseille, he said. And the French troops claimed they were so close to home, they could smell fish and a good soup of bouillabaisse. There they toasted France with the last of the red wine that had been sent them from Brazzaville, 2,300 miles to the south. And they toasted, too, the supplies office of Brazzaville, that somehow had managed, by car and camel and trudging men, to reach them across the field of Africa. They lost only one soldier in a skirmish here. He was skinned alive by a vicious Italian hand grenade which breaks into millions of tiny splinters and shreds the skin from a man for the shock of it is negligible. In contrast to most armies, these 3 French who are defending Central Africa and our own supply lines to the east, never boast of their morals. They take it for granted, partly because they must be fatalist, but largely because of their utmost love and respect for General Leclerc, whom they describe by the Arab name, Baraka, the Invincible. The captured native troops invariably beg to be allowed to search for the bullets they have shot at him, that supposedly have fallen flat at his feet. And all the Italians I talked to called him El Grandissimo General. But he has not yet put his general stars on the sleeve. He will wear his super uniform, he says, until he is Douglas, Dent, and Hitler's, not Mussolini's, troops. And he hold the fort of the Tibestes for France and her allies until that day comes. I will turn now to New York.
You've just heard from Hassel Davis, NBC reporter in Free French Equatorial Africa, speaking direct from Brazzaville. His report was relayed to the United States via RCA Communications and came to you through the newsroom in New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.